welcome to a Listen to Older Voices Golden Moments program. And brought to you through the Toorak Times. This is a repeat program from our archives that we believe has merit enough to rebroadcast so that the story and the person's life can be shared with those who may have missed it the first time. Hello, I'm Rob Greaves, and thank you for joining me on another fascinating Listen to Older Voices program. This week is part one of a three-part program featuring the life and times of 75-year-old Mink van der Slik. Mink commences her journey recalling in graphic detail of what life was like in Holland under German occupation during the Second World War. Living in the family home with Germans occupying parts of the house, life was always on the edge, with her father being a major player in the underground, and she includes stories that may have come from a Robert Ludlum novel, except they're all factual. Amongst her stories are those about Jewish refugees being kept safe in the house, and how, despite the war, there was kindness by some German soldiers. Detailed, interesting, and well told. Join me now as I speak with Mink. Well, first of all, Mink, thank you very much for coming in and speaking with me. And could I start by asking you when you were born and where were you born?
I was born on the 29th of August 1934 in a southern city of Holland. And we lived outside that city for a long time in a lovely old house where it was lovely to grow up, with a big garden and an apple orchard, and you know, it was really countryside.
You have good memories of that?
I have very good memories of that, because I was the youngest of seven and I was spoiled rotten, because my mother had me when she was quite surprised that she had another baby when she was over 40.
That is unusual.
So that was unusual, so everybody sort of, you know, looked after me, and, you know, so it was really good. On the other hand, sometimes it was a little bit lonely because the others were older.
Right.
And I was, of course, still with my dolls in the corner and, you know, had an imaginary friend what I used to talk to in a big, under a big oak tree in the garden, you know, thinking that somebody would come out of that beautiful tree. I remember that because I was always looking at pictures of, you know, sort of fairy tales and all that sort of thing.
Had a good imagination.
Yeah, it was just a little bit of a dreamer, I think. But you do that quite often if you're on your own, I think.
You do. Yes. Talking about that, is that your earliest memory, or do you have earlier memories than that?
I haven't, actually. No, I couldn't say that I had, because that would have been when I was around about four or five.
I think.
I can't remember anything before that.
Tell us a little bit about Mum and Dad. What was Dad like?
Dad was okay, but he was always very busy. He was a teacher at a secondary college. He taught botany and natural history and all those sort of things. And he taught, what else did he teach? Geography. And he was always involved in everything that happened at the school, you know, took quite a lot of groups of people out into, you know, into the woods, and they were all sort of dismantling flowers and grasses, and he did that sort of on hand knowledge, you know, and study for them.
So. Did he bring that sort of that curiosity into the home? Did he encourage you as children to sort of investigation?
Yes, because I remember that he took me once, you know, because we lived opposite a smaller woods, you know, and he took the classes into there, and I used to sort of, you know, go along around about when I was six or seven or something. And, you know, we all used to sit down and get the little flowers and, you know, and it was really quite interesting, yes. But for the rest, I can imagine that my family always was in music. My father played the violin, my brother played the violin, we all had piano lessons, we all went to, you know, concerts and all that sort of thing. It was a very classical sort of, you know. And the house, that is what I remember too. The house was always full of newspapers and magazines and, you know, sort of a bit of a... that was what I remember very much.
So. What about Mum? What was she like?
My mother, having seven children, of course, was always quite busy.
Yes.
And I have the great admiration for her that she could sort of really dish up these beautiful meals for all these people, and everybody was always welcome, and, you know, family came over in the holidays and when they lived in the city, and they loved our house because, you know, it was just so outdoor.
Yes.
Places, and they played games at night, you know, and card games and all that, and she made everybody welcome. She was very well liked. Yes.
Is family grouping like that very important to Dutch people?
Yes, definitely, definitely. It still is. I do feel that I've been back to Holland last year, and we're only the four of us left now. I have one brother left and two sisters.
Right.
But it's all with family, you know. It's really very nice. Very nice.
I ask that because it was very much like that in Australia, certainly when I was a child, but I look around me now and I don't quite see the same sort of family social interaction anymore. And it's interesting that you said you've gone back to Holland. Is that still the case now in Holland? Is that family grouping still as strong?
Well, I think in my family it is, but right. It is definitely changed too. But then Holland has changed too, you see. You have got so many outside influences now. You know, there's a lot of Turks and Moroccans,
right.
And, you know, there's lots of intermingling of races, and that creates a different society altogether.
It has its positives and its negatives, doesn't it? It has.
You know, it is interesting, but it is not always... It's a different society, I feel.
That's interesting, because I think we're experiencing that in Australia now, where we...
Yes.
I mean, it's a young country, so it's struggling to find its own identity, but a lot of people would say that with a large influx, particularly from Asia, that it changes the nature of the culture quite drastically.
Yes.
And I guess only time will tell whether it's for the better or the worse.
Yes, you could never tell, could you, really? And also here in Australia, I think when you look at the Italian families and the families from China or wherever they come from, Asia, they are different, you know, than Australians can have maybe two or three children, but they have got... larger families, you know, and if you go on a Sunday to a park, for instance, you know, you see all these foreign nationalities sit together and have barbecues and all that sort of thing.
Mm.
And I don't know whether the Australians do that so much. I don't know.
Well, it doesn't appear to be that way.
Not anymore.
No, not anymore.
We used to do that with our children, but not
anymore. Well, talking about children, let's keep to you as a child. Having a father as a teacher, was there an expectation that you would do well in school? And did you do well in school?
I did do well in school, yes. We all did, actually. I think that it was sort of developed in the house. It's an automatic development, I think. It's just something that you did, you know. There was always reading, and we were always members of libraries, and, you know, we were always encouraged to read, and I could always go to my father and ask, you know, if something was, you know, that I didn't understand or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, yes, it was. It had
did
an
you
influence.
Enjoy going to school?
I did. I did, actually. I went to a primary school in our area where there were lots of farmers, and you felt a little bit out of it because you were not in that sort of environment, if you know what I mean, you know? They all had to come home and, you know, and do a lot of milking and all that sort of thing. So when I came into grade 5... my parents decided to let me do the last 2 years of primary school in the city.
Okay.
And that is, I was too young to go on the bike, but, you know, there was a bus. So I went to the city to prepare me for secondary education, because most of these children that were at my school used to go to the farm. They stayed home, or they went into service or something like that.
Now, you would have been quite young when the Second World War started. Did that interfere with your life very much?
Oh, very much so, very much.
In what way?
Well, I was 6 when the war broke out, And, well, we all were in 1940 in the cellar, you know, because the bombing kept on and on and on. And then life sort of dragged on. But my father had to leave the secondary school because the Germans took over the city, mm-hmm. and they wanted to decide what was going to be taught at the schools and what not. Now, he completely disagreed with that, and he decided to sort of, you know, he had a warning that if he was too outspoken what he was, then something would happen. So he went underground, right? In the underground.
And you've tuned into Listen to Older Voices. Turning Back Time. Turning Back Time.
And then one day we were all sitting at the table, and that is something that is very clear in my mind. My eldest brother said, "Now, what are we going to do if the Germans are coming in the house? What are we going to do?" Because we were hiding two Jews.
Oh, okay.
And he was supposed to go to Germany to work, and so was my second brother, and they were not going.
Mm-hmm.
So
no.
It was a bit of a thing. So he said, "Now just have a look around." He said, "Well, I'm not going to stay here because I feel it is becoming too dangerous." Because he was already in the underground and courier, so he knew more about everything that was happening.
Yes.
And so he looked around, and then my father was home then, and he said, "Well, I go into the cellar where we had the heating system." He said, "You know, and I'll go and see if I can sneak out to the back garden or something." And my brother and one of the Jews were going to go upstairs and going onto the water reservoir, what we had, you know, the water tank.
Yes.
There was just a tiny little spot where they could sit. And then the other Jew looked around in the lounge and said, "Well, we had a central heating, and it was in a sort of cupboard, and there was a little door there." And he said, "Well, I'll sneak in there. I think I can do it. We can put the standing reading lamp in front of it and the couch. And, you know, you can hardly see that it is so." Well, lo and behold, we're sitting at the table at the next day. And all of a sudden, the car stops. And there was a German and one traitor, because he was Dutch, you know. And he walked around the house. And he went and stood at the exit of that heating system where my father was hiding. So he couldn't get out. But while my father, because it was so unexpectedly, so when my father walked through a room to that place, the Dutchman saw him. And that's why he stood outside at the exit. He knew my father was coming out, but my father wasn't coming out. He was hiding.
Mm.
And the guy was too afraid to go in. You know, it was a dark place. So anyhow, the German came in, and I remembered so, because he had his a pistol in front of my mother and said, "Where is your husband?"
Wow.
And she said, "Well, I don't know." She was a very strong woman, you know.
She must
really,
have been, because that would have been a very scary situation.
And he said, "Well, you better tell me, and otherwise I'll shoot you," and all that, and we were just sitting there. My mother said, "Well, look, I don't know where he is. You took him a long time ago to Germany, and we haven't seen him." So that was it.
Yes.
And he wasn't going to shoot her, of course. So he went through the house and looked everywhere. And then he wanted to go upstairs. And it was sort of quite a steep stairs to the bedrooms, you know, the old houses. And I think basically he was too afraid to go up on his own. So he called that other guy and said, "Well, look, come inside, and because I want to look upstairs." And he said, "Yeah, but I'm standing at an exit, and I think, you know, I've seen him." And he said, "No, you have to come here." And as he was, of course, the one with the...
Yes, authority.
Authority. So he came inside, and in the meantime, my father...
Did get out.
And, you know, so I didn't see my father for the rest of the war.
Gosh.
But was still, yes, because he was in the underground, and our house was always watched because, you know, we they thought he was
this very back. Were you scared during all this, or were you too young to actually even be scared?
I think I was too young to be really actually scared. I relied too much on the others. I was speaking to one of my sisters last year, and with her it is just so still clear what happened, you know, because she was much older than
I
was.
Yes, so it affected her more.
Yes, she was, around about 13 or 14 at that stage, you see, when the war... older, because this didn't happen in 1940. Mm. I was six then, so it was a bit later.
People listening probably wouldn't forgive me if I didn't just ask you, the two Jewish people that you were hiding, they obviously didn't get discovered either.
Oh, well, I tell you, the ones that were planning to go... upstairs was a Jew and my second brother, mm-hmm. you know, who was still around about 18, I think.
Mm.
And they took them.
They did take them.
Yeah, they did, and put them in jail in the city. But you couldn't see he was a Jew.
Oh, okay.
He didn't have... The other one who was hiding was a real Jew.
Yes, had all the features.
But this one not. So they were in jail, you see. So my father didn't want his son in jail.
Mm.
So he, after a week, he said, well, if they don't let Tom go, I'll come back and I'll, you know, give myself up. Because I don't want him to sit in jail on camp. Because they were going to send him to Germany to work, you see.
In the labor camps.
In the labor camps. So anyhow, after a fortnight, the so my brother had sent a little note and said, no, don't let Dad do that, you know, I'll be okay even if I go to Germany. But anyhow, after a fortnight, they freed them.
Gosh, that must have been a relief to your mum.
My mother was really, you know...
Yes.
Very... but I... My mother was amazing because she brought us all up during the war. And our house, that was another thing, what I remember very strongly, that they took our house, you see, because it was a big house. So one day a German came and said, well, look, we need your house because for the officers... And we had a very large sunroom in front of the lounge, and they wanted a table there, and they could have dinner there and all that, and then they would use, and we could use one of the back rooms, which we and they needed to have the kitchen, and my mother was allowed to be in the kitchen from 7 to 8 at night, so we were always eating very
late. So you shared the house?
Yes. There was one sleeping upstairs. And an officer, and the others came only for dinner and sitting in the lounge and, you know, having their cigars and whatever, and drinks and all that.
That must have been very hard on your mum to stomach all of this.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And she couldn't use the kitchen before they're finished. But what I remember very strongly is that I used to sneak into the kitchen as a little girl, and there were two Germans who were very sweet because they were sort of homesick, I think. Mm. And I remember that one of them was particularly fond of me. And my mother discovered, because we all spoke a bit of German, that he was so fond of me because he had a daughter the same age. So there was nothing... you know, wrong with it, that he was so fond of me.
No, it just reminded me of his own family.
Of his own family. And he used to give me those big jars or mugs or whatever you call them with soup for our family. So we had to eat through me being there in the kitchen that we got some food, good food, for the rest of the family. You know.
So it was just pure luck.
Pure luck it was, yeah. Mm. But they were human.
Yes.
But then on the other hand, you know, I remember my sister still telling about a party that the officers had, and they were all drunk. And my sisters were at the age that, you know, they could have been in trouble.
Mm.
And they were upstairs, all they barricaded the doors and all that because they wanted to go upstairs. And, oh, dear, she said the fright, she still feels that, still that fear of what they would do if they would come, you know, upstairs.
Yes, indeed.
You know, so.
I mean, it's the fear of the unknown that is really bad, isn't it? I mean, you just expect something to happen. You don't know what, but you know any moment it can happen.
Listen to older voices, where stories from the past find a home in the present.
What do you remember, what do you recall about the end of the war? Do you remember how you learnt about the end of the war?
Well, the end of the war was traumatic for the whole family because all the people that there was a house at the back of us, an hour away from us, where there were a lot of people that were hiding there, and they were in the underground, and that was their sort of office. And my father was the, you know, commander of it, but wasn't living there. He was living somewhere else at some family member of us or something. And then we had couriers coming to our house and getting all the messages from my father and bringing them over the fields to this other place. Well, the other place got attacked by the Germans, and they were all killed. And they were very good friends of my father. There were other teachers from the school. It was really awful for him. And then my mother got a message that we should really leave the house because they were coming to get us, you see. So my mother packed a couple of bags, and my younger brother and I, a sister and a younger brother and me, we walked all the way, hours and hours, to a girl that used to clean our house, and they had a farm. And I had a lovely time. I really did. I had a lovely time there because I was allowed to feed the chickens and, you know. And
For your age, for even though it's
age,
awful, it's an adventure.
It was an adventure, you know. We had to sleep in a loft, my brother and I, and he was 2.5 years older than I am. And the two of us had a ball.
Yes.
Because we were allowed to work in on the farm and go out with the horses, and it was lovely. It was really lovely. But then we had to leave there again, and that was the end. The south of Holland was liberated earlier, you see. So we decided to go. It was getting a bit dangerous for the farmer as well. So one of my sisters was very involved with a convent in a village a little bit further away. And we ended up there in the cellar when the bombing started and everything, you know. And then the south of Holland was liberated and we could go back home.
Was your entire family reunited?
Yes, yes. My eldest sister was not living with us. She was living with her. She was engaged, you know. She was much older, of course, than we were. And she lived with his family for a while. And she was a dental assistant or something. And my other sister wanted to become a nun.
Mm-hmm.
So she was always hiding in convents. And for the rest, yes, there was my brothers I didn't see, because they were in the underground.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yep. So it was only my one of my sisters and my young brother and me that were sort of really involved in that sort of, you know, area.
How long, I mean, again, you're only 10 years of age, you're 10 or 11 when the war finished, so you're still a youngster. But from your memories, how long did it take for things to get back to normal after the end of the war?
Oh, well, it didn't go back to normal because it was only the south that was liberated, and the north had the hunger winter, they call it in Holland, where they had no food. This was the west of Holland, you know, like Amsterdam and, you know, the bigger places and all that sort of thing. And England, of course. And then the Germans were, I don't know how you call it, flying these V1s, you know?
Yes, the flying buzz bombs.
Yes. They shot in Germany. They came over Holland to England.
Oh, to England.
And then we were all warned that if they stop the sound of them, when you can hear them coming, And I can still hear that. It's funny because I was around about 10 then. And my sister and I used to stand in front of the window and you could see that light coming over at night, you know, and you could see and you can hear the sound. And then one day, the sound stopped, and then you know that it didn't work.
You're in trouble.
Trouble.
Yes.
And they came down, so we all went under the beds and all that, and then all the windows were broken, and it came down two houses away from us. And the exhaust pipe of that machine was near our kitchen window. And one of my brothers was standing in front of the window, what he shouldn't have done, and he had, you know, he had to have an eye operation. It, you know,
glass.
One of the glass came in.
Join Mink and myself next week as she shares more of her story, including how a buzz bomb on its way to London fell out of the sky and exploded near her house, and the role of her father in post-war reconstruction. The story of Mink Vanderslick on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is podcast to you through the Toorak Times and TAG.